Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Ospreys are back. Yay.
Ospreys are back. They're back in force.
Yeah.
Somebody in West Falmouth was like, I haven't seen any ospreys. Someone else was like, really? They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. That's right. You know, we were driving and I said that. I was like, oh, the ospreys are back. And Jackson said, why are you so excited about that? I was like, are you kidding me? Now, if I said, look, a flock of robins.
Yes. He knows what he likes. Yeah, that's funny. But people generally get excited about them. You know, they're big. They can see them. It's a clear milestone in the progression of spring. And, you know, they're fun to have around. And there are so many of them now.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable how many ospreys are. And what I've seen in the growth of the population and our understanding of how big the population is over the last like 15 to 20 years. And so just Falmouth. So back then somebody would have said, there's like 150 nests on the Cape or something like that. Just the town of Falmouth has 150 osprey nests right
now. Isn't that crazy?
And we know that thanks to Kevin Friel, who's sort of the lead on that remarkable Falmouth osprey project, this town-based grassroots effort to get ospreys off the power lines, and started with Kevin trying to photograph and document every nest in the town. And it's gone up 20 just in the last, 4 years or something like that. The estimate has. And so it's 150 nests just in Falmouth.
Amazing, isn't it?
So imagine how many are on the Cape. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're here. And now they'll, when will we see the little baby ospreys? That's a couple months away or not?
Oh, the widow baby? The widow babies?
The widow babies, yeah.
They're not exactly cute. It's funny that, you know, they're like little wretched little dinosaurs that only a mother could love. But I don't know. I think they're kind of cute.
I think,
but they like don't have feathers, and they're, you know, they look sort of sinister. It's a while. It'll be a while.
Yeah.
It'll be summer.
Yeah. All right.
Late spring, summer. The incubation. I'm trying to remember the length. I always forget the exact length of the incubation period, but it's more than a month. And so these big birds, they take a long time to work through their nesting cycle, the incubation period, and then the nestling period until, you know, it's July and August before the chicks are big and getting ready to practice flying and eventually fledge on their own. And we get to watch the whole thing playing out in plain sight.
Yay, I know.
You know, I mean, thanks to DDT, the pesticide and eggshell thinning and all that back in the 50s and 60s, the population crashed, but now they're back. We did the right things to bring them back. It's a great conservation success story, and people get to watch them just about everywhere. They're nesting all over the place.
Since we're talking about nesting, we already have an email about nestings from Carol in Falmouth who says, please tell us a little about nest building. This is the season. How can we observe without intruding, especially for birds like robins who choose locations so close at hand? How long does it take to build a nest, and how long does it need to last? I noticed that the old ones I can observe that remain from last year tend to be 10 to 15 feet off the ground. What determines how high or low birds build? Does it take a few years for younger birds to learn the building trade? What birds never make nests? There's a lot of nest questions in there.
Hey, pick a question and go with it. I have very limited. My short-term memory can't handle a multi-part question like that.
It's really amazing if you look at some of those nests. I mean, some of them got the sloppy nests like the mourning doves, right? But then some of those other nests are so beautiful and intricate, right?
Oh, there's some that are amazing. I love vireo nests are nice, but I guess oriole nests are the ones that are so beautifully woven and they dangle gracefully down from a fork and a branch. That those are the ones that people would see most often that are really nicely constructed. And yeah, you nailed it. At the other end of the spectrum is a mourning dove who like throws a few sticks somewhere. And, you know, they're just, I don't know how they're so common. They're sort of like, is real half-arsed nesting attempt. And anyway, mourning doves are on eggs right now, I'm sure. Some of these birds do nest very close to us. Robins, house finches, Carolina wrens, and they can kind of deal with the intrusion. Otherwise, they wouldn't nest next to your back door. You know, you don't have to worry too much about them. the question was about observing nesting without being too intrusive. Yeah, it's good to think about that, but you know, we monitor nest boxes and researchers, we monitor nests all the time to the point where we're literally taking the chicks out of the nest and banding them. I do that with purple martins at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. I take the chicks out and I put color bands on them and a U.S. Fish and Wildlife band on them, and I usually do it as a demo for our day camp kids. It's a cool way for them to see research in action. But yeah, I mean, they can handle a certain amount of intrusion, these species that nest around us. And we check the bluebird nest. You open the side, you look in there, and it's a momentary intrusion, but that's how we get the data, and it doesn't affect them really. So it's not something you have to be paranoid about because the birds are pretty resilient to momentary disturbances. And again, especially the ones that are nesting in the shrub next to your front door, the catbirds and robins and house finches, like I was talking about. Boy, there were so many other
It was
questions.
like she said she noticed they're like 10 to 15 feet off the ground. But it depends on the bird, right? The birds have different preferences of where they're going to build their nests, right?
Yeah. It starts on the ground. There are a lot of ground nesting birds. There are birds that nest underground, burrowing owls, and there were some songbirds I remember in Africa that would nest in little burrows under the ground. And other, you know, kingfishers nest in burrows, kind of horizontal burrows in a bank, swallows. But some birds like to nest on the ground. Certain sparrows, certainly grassland birds, will have a nest just right on the ground, hidden in a grass tussock. All the way up to canopy nesting species that like to be closer to the top of a tree and everything in between. I would say most things are kind of your average bird nests pretty close to the ground or mid-level shrubs, you know, low canopy, and can be fairly easy to observe. And then you have all the cavity nesters. Chickadees like to nest in a cavity that's not too low. I mean, not too high, I mean. And so you can often observe a chickadee nest. Sometimes it's like chest high or you know, head high even. And the woodpeckers don't need to be very high either. And so it's nice that we have a lot of birds that we can kind of observe their nesting pretty close, but
We know our dog passed away, so we don't have the dog to hassle the birds this year. But
oh
the
no.
last couple of years, we've had chickadees in a little cavity in the apple tree, and that dog just whatever is obsessed with that with the birds in there. So I'm hoping they come back this year. They'll have a quiet time this year instead of being hassled by the dog all the time.
Yeah, and how did they do? Did they fledge chicks?
Yes, three.
Yeah, so they're fine.
I
Yeah.
didn't see last year what chicks came, but the year before, three. I just happened to be outside when the little chicks flew on top of the shed and up into the
Oh,
apple
that's right.
tree, and
Yeah, that's it's rare to see that. To actually catch the fledging is so rare.
Oh, it was, yeah.
I've done so much nest monitoring, and you're just sort of guessing. You're like, you just show up one day and they're gone. Like,
Yeah.
well, yeah, I think they fledged.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe you still see them in the area. Like with bluebirds, you see them kind of nearby tending the recently fledged nestlings.
Yeah.
But oftentimes you're just like, I don't know, I
Yeah, it
guess they
was
fledged. The
awesome.
nest is empty.
Yeah, and it was really fun to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, chickadees. I don't know what's going on with chickadees. They're a lot less common than titmice are in many places now. And I saw a paper. It seems that titmice outcompete chickadees when they're in the same area. And that certainly is the case in my neighborhood. And I wonder what's going on. I looked at our banding data. 10 years of banding data were coming up. It's the 10-year anniversary of our bird banding station at Wellfleet Bay under James Shunda, the master bander. And the chickadees are just going straight down. And
Really?
I don't know what's going on. You know, different things happen. Like sometimes we'll get an influx of young birds from further north. They don't really migrate, but you'll get in some years there'll be a bumper crop, and young birds from further north will disperse south. But they're very non-migratory overall. They don't like to cross water. The canal is like too much for them to fly across practically. And so I'm a little bit curious, and I want to talk to some other bird banding stations and see what kind of trends people are seeing with chickadees. It's one of those things It's not a bird you'd ever think you'd have to worry about,
I
but
know, right?
we look at what happened with the common bats, just little brown bats just used to be everywhere, and now they're on the every endangered species list you can think of because of white nose syndrome. So, things can happen to common things, and it's good to
Well,
keep an eye on them.
I hope not. They're one of my favorites. I love chickadees. They're
I mean,
just
I think
so
they'll be
cute.
fine for a while. It's just it's just kind of an interesting short-term trend, at least locally.
Well, speaking of nesting, we have the beach nesting birds too, right? Popping plovers have started to show up. So when will we see those nests being
Yes.
constructed?
They're back.
They're
Shut down
back.
the beaches. No one can go to the beach anymore.
That's not true.
At least, no, it's not at all true. But to listen to some people, you'd think they put up razor wire and no one could go to the beach anymore. But yeah, the plovers are back, and it's too early for a nest. Usually, you see the first piping plover nest mid-April would be the very first one in the state, and then it really gets going late April, early May. Most of my pairs on the Outer Cape seem to wait until May to start dropping eggs, and they drive you nuts because we monitor them, right? And we're collecting data on them, and so we're out there, and they're scraping, they're making their little, nest scrape in the ground, and they're maintaining it, and days go by, and there's still no egg. Like, what are you doing? They're just toying with us, and then they end up nesting somewhere completely differently than where they had been scraping. So they just sort of troll us for a while, make it seem like they're about to nest, and then they'll wait until May. But they're establishing territories. Some places it's still just a lonely male kind of waiting for a female to come back. He's holding down a section of beach waiting for a lady to come along. But they are back, and the numbers will keep building, and you'll see the little string fencing going up in the upper beaches, and the beaches with driving, like Nauset Beach and Sandy Neck. They have their habitat conservation plans, and they have their management plans in place for dealing with that and getting people out on the beaches even when the plovers are there. So a lot of those old kind of problems have been solved in a kind of a compromised way to still get trucks out on beaches where you have unfledged piping plover chicks. And so that's good. The towns still get revenue, and they're still able to protect the birds. So there's a
We share the
system
beach.
for that. We
We have
share the
to learn to
beach.
share.
Share the beach.
It's
Exactly.
bird news this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. And again, we'll talk about other critters too. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another sure sign of spring is the chorus of the peepers. Have you been hearing them?
Oh, the peepees. Yes. Yeah, they start really early, end of February sometimes and all through March. And, the spotted salamanders are moving and wood frogs. Heard some wood frogs at a pool in the Punkhorn in Brewster the other day. And they already have egg masses in there. But the peepers are obviously they're the most obvious amphibian of very early spring that everybody notices. I mean, they're just so loud. And it just carries through the cool night air. And they're so great. They're not picky. They'll be in the little wet spot behind the gas station. They don't need pristine wetlands. And so that's kind of a nice thing about peepers. And you listen to all of them and you're like, where are they the rest of the time? Occasionally you'll see one. I'll see one crossing a road on a wet night or something like that. Or occasionally one will end up on your deck under a pillow or something like that. But overall, they're incredibly common, but you never see them. They're
Yeah,
just
they're
so
tiny.
tiny.
Yeah, so small.
And then they just, after they're done breeding, they just head back out into the woods and sort of disappear.
All right.
Very cool little frogs.
They are. Paul's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi, Mindy. Hi, Mark. You can hear me?
Yeah.
Hello.
Oh, great. Hi. I just was very lucky last night. Right outside our house, we had a great horned owl. And I'm just wondering a little about their life cycle and And then also in the context of the nesting behavior, I was reading that they like to be quite high up in a tree in a kind of little mesh platform. So questions about great horned owls.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Sure.
You're welcome.
Yeah, they seem, yeah, they've been very vocal lately. I've been hearing at least two or more at my house and, you know, other places. Rooster heard them. They seem to be getting vocal again, but they're in their nesting period. Like they're on eggs right now. And they like a stick nest just somewhere up in a tree. And they're lazy. They like to take over nests from other birds. You know, they might fix up an old crow nest. They love to take over great blue heron nests in a rookery. So every great blue heron rookery has a great horned owl that takes over one of the nests. And if you haven't seen these, it's a bunch of big stick nests in a swamp with a bunch of drowned dead trees. You've probably seen, like, I annually after we go to Easter, my sister's in Concord, we're driving down Route 2 and we see one. It's like the one time a year I get to see a great blue heron rookery, and the great blue herons were back on the nest. But I'm sure somewhere in there was a great horned owl on one of those nests. And they start in February. They have a very, really long incubation period. I think it's over a month. It's like up to 37 days or something like that, according to what I just surreptitiously Googled up. It's radio. They can't see what I'm doing.
That's right. You didn't have to tell them.
They don't know I don't really know anything that I haven't Googled.
That's not true.
Yes. And so, you know, they have a long nestling period, and then the nestlings are kind of loud and they don't hoot. They just make this raspy sound, this ree. And that's the only sound they'll make for a full year, as far as I understand it. And then they don't get their hooting license until they're a year old. And then they sound like what we expect great horned owls to sound like, the
I love that.
That sort of,
yeah,
staccato
hearing that in the
rhythm.
Middle of the,
yeah,
night. Yeah. Yeah.
And don't confuse it with the barred owl, who are getting more and more common. They're very well established on the Upper Cape, certainly Falmouth, Sandwich, Mashpee, those areas. They're just, barred owls are in the mix, mm-hmm, and they kind of sound like a distant barking dog sometimes, like,
yeah. That was a good indication.
Yeah, thanks. I practiced.
Yeah.
I sometimes I'll do that to try to call them in, owling on a Christmas bird count or whatever. I remember down at, a lot of people have probably been to Corkscrew Swamp in the winter. You go down to like Ding Darling and the Corkscrew Swamp National Audubon Sanctuary down there in Southwest Florida. And there was, you know, a pair of barred owls in there. Barred owls are really common in southern swamp forest. And this was many years ago. And my brother was visiting, and I turned to him and I said, they sound like, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? I just said it. And the owl responded. I just said the words. I didn't even
That's
do
so
the.
So funny.
And we look. Oh, there it is. And it turned out funny. It was like right over our heads. He's like, yeah, that is what it sounds like. Let me answer you back.
Do they come back to the same nest again, or no?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
We don't know. Okay.
We certainly know with ospreys. The owls are a little more cryptic. And if anybody has, like, oh, the great horned owls nest in the same place in my yard every year and they always come back,
let us know.
I want to know that, because, yeah, I actually don't know the answer to their nest site fidelity. They have to move. They get harassed a lot. And so my gut is that they have to kind of move it around,
yeah,
to throw the crows off the scent, because the crows
are smart. Yeah.
The crows really harass them a lot. And so, it probably behooves them, no owl pun intended, to move around from year to year.
Yeah.
The crows will eventually find them. It's sort of pointless. There's so many crows now, but I'm postulating.
All right. Thank you. Stan is calling from Truro. Hi, Stan.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for taking the call. I have a question. We love your bird reports on Wednesday on CAI, and I'm glad this longer conversation is going on. We have what appears to be flickers. I'm not sure for sure, but they are up in the eave of the house, and sometimes they will pound on the side of the house like a woodpecker. We thought at first they were woodpeckers. It's like living inside of a drum. We try to chase them out, and then they keep coming back. It doesn't appear to be a nest up there. Can you tell us what's going on?
Sure. Yeah, they are a woodpecker. I mean, they're not called flicker woodpecker, but they are a woodpecker. And they do woodpecker things, but they're different than other woodpeckers around here. I call them ground peckers. They eat a lot of ants and they spend a lot of time on the ground foraging for them. They're literally pecking dirt in the way that other woodpeckers peck the side of a tree. They certainly peck trees as well. They excavate. They're very important for other cavity nesters. Flickers are. They're sort of a keystone species in a way because they create the cavities that are big enough for things like screech owls and saw-whet owls, these secondary cavity nesters who nest in cavities but don't make their own. So they depend on flickers to make cavities that they can nest in, flying squirrels, things like that. But flickers are famous for being annoying around houses in the spring. It's just how it is. They'll make holes in the shingles. They'll make holes in the rake boards, and they pound on the chimney cap. They like to make noise to advertise their territory and just kind of like warming up their pecking muscles. Whatever they're doing, they're annoying in the spring. And then they'll go away. And if they're damaging your house, you know, there are all these tricks, mylar strips and this kind of thing. But, you know, if those things don't work, you might have to put up some netting if they're like really damaging the siding. Just put up some bird netting to physically keep them away from that part of the house. But generally, they'll move on eventually.
Yeah. Stan, thanks for the question. I know there are probably other people out there having the same problem as Stan.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Steve is giving us a call. He's out and about. We don't know where he is. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Good. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah. Good morning.
All right. All right. Sorry. Good morning. I love listening to your show. Question I had was my daughter and I were driving this past Saturday through Harbor Wareham 58. There's a pond near the I think it's called the Berry Guys. And it looked like there was about 20 swans together.
Wow.
And we've never seen that. So I think she looked it up and said it was mating season. Does that sound right?
Yeah, but that doesn't explain why there's 20. That's sort of the opposite of what you'd expect in mating season. But yeah, there are just a lot. And southeastern Mass, Rhode Island, is sort of swan central. And those are the places where you'll see, you know, dozens sometimes, but it's more typical to just have a pair, and they're definitely on nests right now. There are ponds that I drive by that you can just see the incubating swan on the nest already, but others are not paired up.
Yeah.
They don't migrate. So I'm not totally clear why there would be 20, just a bunch of young birds that haven't like figured out where they're going to live for the summer and whether they're going to try to nest or not. So maybe non-breeding.
It was definitely
non-breeding.
Odd.
Yeah.
I was driving. So I didn't get a good look, but I said, oh, it looked like 10. She's like, no, there was more. She's also 11, but it was a lot more. It was a lot more than I was used to seeing. I've only seen a pair, just like you said, and yeah. I understood that they meet, they stay together for life or something. But that was all. Love
all right.
Your show.
Yeah, Steve,
I
listen
to it all the time.
Yeah.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Thanks,
Thank
Steve.
You.
Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Jackson's in school right now, but I did tell him I would ask you a question. In his Easter basket, the Easter Bunny brought him a hummingbird feeder, and he's very excited about his hummingbird feeder. And when can we put it outside? And I know there are other people going, when can I put my hummingbird feeders out?
Boy, Easter Bunny really knows him well.
No, doesn't. Yeah, doesn't he or she?
mid-April around here is when the first scouts appear. you know, and it seems early, but the Cape in particular seems to get the first few legitimate reports in the state. And there's that website that I'm remembering. I just got to Google it up. But there's, if you just Google, you know, hummingbird migration map, it'll come up. And so there's a map that tracks the progress of reports of the first hummingbirds kind of north through the eastern U.S. And I haven't, it's a little early to check it. You know, they're probably in Florida and places like that mm-hmm. already. But yeah, by mid-April, have that feeder out. Unless you're that one house in Orleans that never put it away because you've got these pesky two rufous hummingbirds that spent the whole winter at your house.
That's amazing.
They'll be ready. You know, the first ruby throats are going to come back and be like, what is this? What, the two hummingbirds here already? What? Who are you?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. All right. So then we also have what, some early overshoot migrants who are here. You said there's a swallow-tailed kite, right?
Yes. And so that happened last month, which was, you know, 3 days ago.
Was it just a couple of days ago? Yeah.
But this was a couple of weeks ago. And so when you get the right winds in early spring, even in March, you'll get these birds that were kind of on their way north. They had no intentions of coming this far north, but they were on their way from, in the case of the swallow-tailed kite that was seen in Chatham, Harwich, and Orleans by different people over a couple of days in like mid-March, or maybe the third week in March. Anyway, that bird was probably coming from South America back to Florida for breeding season. And somehow circumstances put it out over the water. It got caught with this pretty strong southwest wind, and it ended up out over the water, getting pushed further north. And by the time it made its way back to land, it was here. And it ended up in, you know, Orleans and Chatham. And it's kind of looking around like, boy, this doesn't feel like, you know, the Everglades. And it has to figure out what to do. We don't really know what they do, but if it happens later in the spring when the weather's nicer, some of them just stay. That we know. And just to stay on the kites for a second, because there are other, you know, early spring overshoots that have happened and that we can expect going forward in the next few weeks. But with these kites, they don't belong anywhere near here. I mean, they don't nest commonly north of Georgia, the swallowtail kites. And there's another kind of kite, the Mississippi kite, that nests in the deep south as far west as Oklahoma, but all, you know, along the Gulf Coast states, but really just that southern tier of states. But they also do the spring overshoot thing. And it's pretty typical to see them out at Pilgrim Heights or somewhere over the dunes in Provincetown in June. You get young Mississippi kites that came too far north, got blown north, many, many states further north than they should be. And that has resulted in a breeding population in like Newmarket, New Hampshire,
really,
of all places, just in a suburban neighborhood, and then somewhere in Connecticut too. So somehow it bookended us. And I can't believe that it hasn't happened in Massachusetts somewhere, but Connecticut and New Hampshire have little pockets of, you know, maybe it's just one pair for many years. And I don't know if there's more nests than that now, but these little pockets of breeding Mississippi kites, totally disjunct, way north of the next closest breeding pair. And then we had a couple summers ago, swallow-tailed kites, even less likely, that were together and seen copulating in late summer in Sandwich. And it was way too late for them to be breeding. They were young birds. I consulted, you know, an old colleague of mine who studies them down in Florida. And yeah, those were young birds. That's when they're migrating. You know, August is when they're migrating, not when they're breeding. They're literally flying back to South America in August. And so, but it was suggestive, like it could happen here. Like if they come back and do that in April, then you could have a swallow-tailed kite nest on Cape Cod, as bizarre as that would be. So the spring overshoot could turn from an oddity and a sort of a natural selection dead end, you know, the Darwin Award for stupidest migrant, to turning into a little breeding population way north. Yeah. And so this is sort of, if you could attribute a purpose to flying the wrong way and all that, you know, if you're able to establish a new successful breeding population, then, you know, it wasn't a totally a dead end behavior evolutionarily.
Yeah.
There are some other overshoot migrants, a really early purple martin up at High Head. And there have been several reports, very early reports of barn swallows who generally don't become common until May. But like March barn swallows is very unusual, but there have been a few. A couple people had a couple more barn swallows in the last couple of days. But in April, when we get warm south winds, we'll get some regular migrants. We might get a movement of kinglets and hermit thrushes, and these kind of and flickers migrate heavily in April, and so we might get some movements of them. But we might also get really early and, you know, out of range southern things like a prothonotary warbler or a yellow-throated warbler, early indigo buntings, and they'll someone will look out and there's a just like a scintillatingly blue male indigo bunting under their feet, and it's shocking because it's just mid-April.
So
you know,
beautiful.
It's not mid-May, it's mid-April, but that happens. They're a classic species that will get pushed north like really early by these south winds. So just keep an eye on the weather, something to look for. I mean, the short-term weather is grim. It's just, you know, cold Cape Cod spring,
exactly.
East relentless east winds, you know, another storm. But hopefully eventually we'll get a nice bubble of warm air from the south, and then we can look out for some of these early birds.
All right. Denny in East Orleans says, we were rather shocked to see three flickers at our feeder 2 weeks ago. Two were on the feeder and one was on the ground underneath. We assumed they were more territorial. These seem to coexist. Your thoughts?
Yeah. You can totally see a flock of flickers. It's wicked common to see a flock of flickers in migration.
Yeah.
And it is a thing in migration in fall and spring. You might be walking down a trail, as I had the experience. It happens a lot, but there's one memory in particular where there was a heavy migration of flickers and they got caught in the fog. It was a couple of Aprils ago, and they ended up, you know, flying in, navigating into barrier beaches and just dropping out into the dunes. And so it was just like flicker, 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 you know, four at a time, just flushing up ahead of you. And that's not that uncommon in migration to see flocks of flickers. So they're not territorial in winter. And if, you know, it's a little bit early for them to have a nest, and they'll be in little groups here and there.
Right.
Yeah.
Sharon is calling from Bourne. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was just over listening to your conversation about the swallowtail kite, and how you said that it was rare. However, on Saturday, I was on the phone with my mom chatting about our Easter plans and looking out the window. I live on the water, and I saw some interesting birds out there. And, of course, we see seagulls all the time. And I said, they look kind of like seagulls, but they're not seagulls. And so I was on the phone with her, and she's trying to name what they might be. And so I looked them up, and I said they have, like, those tails that are, you know, kind of funny shapes. And so I looked them up. I said they look like kind of swallowtail. I said, I think maybe they're called swallowtail. So I looked them up, and sure enough, these swallowtail kites showed up when I looked them up online, and that's exactly what they looked like. So there was a pair of them, and they were swimming over the water. If I remember correctly, I think they were picking up shells and dropping them, just similar to what the seagulls and the osprey do. We see those all the time. And the osprey are bats too, by the way.
Yeah.
I just saw a pair of those in a nest and as well.
Sharon, did you happen to get a photo?
I didn't take a photo, no. When I saw the osprey, we were driving. And the swallowtails, I was on the phone with my mom, and so I just
didn't get a photo.
Take a picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Mr. Bubble Burster, but what you saw were gulls. There's no way swallowtail kites don't swim or drop shells, or you would seeing two would be pretty remarkable. And you're not like, you see a swallowtail kite, you're not like, is that what it is? It's like, holy cow! They're sort of unmistakable, and they're not like aquatic or hanging out on beaches or touching shells, or they're like a forest bird. and you know they take prey out of trees and are exceedingly rare. I see two together, and at this time of year, if we haven't had like a discernible, really strong wind event, would be pretty bizarre. What do you think? Buzzkill here.
So you think it was just a gut?
Well, the behavior descriptions are just gulls. Yeah. I mean, there's no way a swallow-tailed kite.
Sharon's asking if you could think of another bird it might be that would have a tail like something like that.
It's hard to say.
Yeah,
hard to say.
If you see them again, Sharon, get a picture. Get a picture.
If they're dropping shells, they're gulls. I mean, they're just that's all.
Yeah. All right.
So if I can get a picture, is there a place that I could text the picture to?
Yeah, you can send it to us here. We'll send it on to Mark. Yeah. No problem.
The same phone number?
Yeah, you can always call. Yeah, you can always call us at the radio station or send us an email, and we'll be happy to send the picture on. All right. Thanks, Sharon. Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so, every here and there we get a little bit of nicer weather, and everybody wants to get out and start cleaning up their gardens. And you got there's this myth that we should leave the leaves. And so tell us about that. You don't have to, you're not really helping leaving your leaves.
Well, no. You can help if you leave the leaves permanently.
Forever.
The myth is that has gotten out there that was based on a germ of truth or something that this guru, Doug Tallamy, who is sort of a guru of native plants for native insects. He's a professor down at the University of Delaware with all these grad students doing all this great research. And he's written books and he's on the lecture circuit and bringing nature home and all about the importance of native plants, particularly oaks. He has a whole book about oaks and leaf litter. So you look out, if you have any trees, there's leaves under dead leaves on the ground. It's sort of a permanent feature of forest environments and other shrublands, things like that. And it's a very important habitat for all kinds of things, from shrews moving around under there, eating invertebrates all winter long, all year round, the birds that forage in the leaf litter, it's all kinds of insects that are active in the leaf litter year round. They don't even go dormant. They're just under there moving around, not just insects, but all kinds of invertebrates, centipedes and things. And so that's a food source for birds and small mammals all winter long. Permanent leaf litter. Also, there are a lot of like moth caterpillars and things that will pupate in the soil, sometimes under leaf litter. Bumblebees will winter. They don't winter in the leaf litter. They winter in burrows like underground. They'll like maybe in an old chipmunk burrow or something like that, that may be under leaf litter, but really they're not in the leaf litter. They're underground. And it's gotten out there like there's pollinators in the leaves. So I leave my leaves, and they're talking about leaves that fell in November in their garden beds. There's nothing wintering. There's no pollinators wintering in those leaves. They fell in November. The insects have all went to bed way before those leaves fell. They've only been there since November. And they're saying, I leave them until it's been 50 degrees for a few days, and then I rake them out, for the pollinators. And I'm like, nope, there's no pollinators in there. That unless those leaves have been there for year, like 2 years, there's nothing overwintering in there. And so what you do, rake them out in the fall, rake them out in the spring, rake them out in April, rake them out in March, it's of no consequence to wildlife. It doesn't matter. But if you have parts of your yard where you leave permanent leaf litter, which is an important habitat for all kinds of things, including, moths and things that will overwinter under that leaf litter, great. What you do in your garden beds doesn't matter at all to wildlife, but it's become this thing in like social media, well-meaning people like, I wait until it's 50. A tiny fraction of the insects that will fly this year have emerged by the time it's been 50 degrees for a week. Think about it. How many insects do you see in April? they all come out later, right? And so this idea that, well, the insects are all out by the time it's been 50 degrees for a few days in April, like, not even close. Like, the overwhelming majority of bees, butterflies, moths, all of these things emerge way after that. So they're still sleeping somewhere, either where there's permanent leaf litter or, you know, in trees, under the soil, all the different places, under bark, all the different places they overwinter. And they're emerging all through spring, all through summer. These insects are coming out, and some emerging for the first time as late as September. So this idea that all the insects emerge in April once it's been 50 degrees for a few days is just completely biologically untrue. So don't worry about the leaves in your garden beds. Leave them forever. Great. Or, you know, kind of work around them for gardening. I think about doing that. But even I have to remove leaves even from parts of the woods, like the natural woods where I have some trailing arbutus. You know, it's Mayflower, our state flower. The name for it is trailing arbutus, and it's just started blooming in the last week. It's this prostrate, inconspicuous shrub, like a dwarf shrub, basically, that's flat against the ground, mixed in with the leaf litter. It likes cut banks where it can get more sun. I have a patch of it in my yard, which I love, but I have to rake the leaves off of it, even though it's a native plant in the woods. That helps it, and it makes the flowers, you know, easier for the bees to get at and everything. So,
good to know.
Yeah, leaf litter is really permanent leaf litter is very important. If you can create some in your yard, plant native plants, reduce pesticides, like all of the good things you can do to help wildlife.
Reduce pesticides is a big one.
Reduce pesticides, reduce lawn, replace it with, there's some great native seed mixes you can get with, you know, little blue stem and native perennials mixed in, and lots of things you can do. But what you do with the leaves in your garden beds doesn't matter, one way or the
other. Got a couple of emails. Let's see. We have Jill writes, last night I took a bike ride to my Comet Pond and was stopped in my tire tracks by this pretty scene. She sent a couple of really pretty photos of a white heron. So thank you for sharing. And then Richard writes,
so a great egret. A white heron is a white form of the great blue heron that you wouldn't see north of South Florida, but that would be a great.
Okay. Did you look at the pictures?
Egret,
I sent you the pictures.
No.
Oh, they're beautiful. Take a look at the pictures. All right. And then Richard writes, I keep a rubber squeaky ball in my pocket when I take my Jack Russell Terriers out. It helps to herd them. A couple of days ago, I heard a pair of osprey calling to one another a little distance away. They sounded a lot like my squeaky ball. I swear I lured them over my house by squeaking at them.
It's funny you should say that. Yeah, ospreys don't have a very, you know, big, tough call. Bald eagles, same thing. Like these big, tough birds, predatory birds. And they're like, cheep, cheep. You know, they have these pathetic little calls. And so I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
But that reminds me of when I worked in the Pine Rocklands of South Florida. And we were working on brown-headed nuthatches, which were a species of concern down there. And they're, you know, they're like a the size of red-breasted nuthatches. They're a tiny little nuthatch, and they sound like a squeaky dog toy. And so we would literally carry a squeaky dog toy to call them to when we were looking for them, because they were color banded and we were studying them and tracking them. So yeah, it's there is precedent for calling in birds with squeaky toys. Yeah.
All right. So you're saying it's still a good time now to see some wintering waterfowl like the rare king eider in the canal?
Yes, yes, the prince eider. And so the king eider is sort of an uncommon Arctic eider. It's uncommon unless you go to the Arctic in spring. But down here, this is about as far south as they like to go in the winter, and we don't see them very often. You might get one, and you hope to get a male. The males are just crazy looking, just like powder blue and orange and red and green, all these colors. They're just stunning. But this is a young male that turned up among all the common eiders. You may have noticed the canal is full of common eiders. I have to assume there's a bunch of blue mussels down there that they're eating. They eat blue mussels and green crabs. Those are probably the top two things they eat. And so I assume there's a bunch down there. And this king eider was a young male turned up in the common eider flocks down at the Skusset end of the canal. So all the birders have been going down there. So, yeah, I mean, we're all thinking of spring and the migrants returning eventually, but a lot of great winter birds still hanging in there in throughout the month of April, and some will be moving through as well. There'll be a water bird migration happening throughout April. You might get, like, I remember one day when I was lucky enough to live in a house on a bluff on the ocean side of Wellfleet every winter, and I just looked out one day and there were, I think it was April, and there were 500 common loon, I'm sorry, red-throated loons just wow. sitting on the water. Just a blanket of red-throated loons, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And so sometimes you'll have things like that going on, and they're getting a little bit more into breeding plumage. Like maybe you'll catch a grebe. The grebes are gorgeous in breeding plumage, but we typically see them when they're in their gray and white, kind of boring winter plumage, like the loons when we see them here in winter. But you might catch over the next month a horned grebe or even a red-necked grebe getting into their breeding plumage, looking more colorful. So don't forget about our winter birds. Keep an eye on them as they change. Don't get too overly exuberant about the new spring arrivals and forget about the sort of winter riches that we'll still have. And they'll be gone by May, most of them.
Well, so let me ask about the loons that we have here. You know, when you go up into New Hampshire and Maine, that beautiful call. I never hear that here. Is there a reason that they don't, or do they call here and I just am not around to hear it?
Yeah, they do. It's just not as frequent. And they'll often call. You'll hear them if it's a quiet, foggy day. You'll hear the common loons doing all their different calls. And some of them call in flight. Even red-throated loons will call in flight. You'll see them with their mouths, you know, their beaks open up there flying over. They definitely do. It's just a matter of catching it. Yeah. You know, it's certainly not as frequent in the breeding season. You're up on a lake. It's smaller. You can hear them no matter where they are on the lake, and they're calling much more frequently.
It's magical.
It is magical. And we do hear it around here if you can catch it at the right time.
And we should mention, people probably have noticed, bird song is increasing, right? It's getting noisier. And I guess peak will be June, right? That's when we'll really hear everybody pretty much calling.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of the resident birds, yes, at June, by the beginning of June, everything is back. You know, the latest migrants, like the eastern wood pewees and willow flycatchers, the flycatchers that are the last migrants are back. But yeah, all through May, the bird song should be really heavy. And then, you know, it augmented by the migrants that are only coming through for a few weeks, the warblers and things, and then they leave. So I guess you could say mid-May is probably the peak in terms of the number of species you can hear singing. And then by June, we're just left with the local breeders and, you know, 20 species of warblers that don't breed here have moved on. But yeah, May and June is the peak. But it's amazing how early it noticeably, like January, freezing cold days, the birds are clearly singing more, right? And it's because they're responding to day length. They do seem to like a nice day, right? We always talk, well, it's day length and, you know, their circadian rhythms and are tuned to the amount of hours of daylight in the day and their annual rhythms and their endocrine system that determines when their song part of their brain reactivates is determined by day length. But they do seem to like a nice day.
Yeah. Don't we all? Don't we all like a nice day?
Yeah, a nice sunny, calm day. They're all in full song, and it seems like every day, you know, there's more bird song. Yep.
Yep. All right, Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you, Mark.
Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.